Time for In the Garden on the Farm.
The views and opinions expressed during this program are those of the speaker and do not necessarily reflect those of KKCR, its management, staff, board, members, volunteers, or underwriters.
Aloha, and welcome to In the Garden on the Farm, your weekly radio program that cultivates the passion and knowledge to grow well with plants and animals. We're your hosts, Tammy and Paul, and on today's show, we'll hear news of a new threat to the ohia forests of the Big Island, sketch out a new food forest using permaculture principles, and decompose our thoughts on a pillar of our ecosystem, the saprophytic mushrooms. But first, we'd like to let you know that this KKCR program is made possible by listeners like you in partnership with our generous underwriters. Harvest Market Natural Foods and Cafe, Kauai Marine and Mower, Anahola Stringed Instruments, and Edible Hawaiian Islands Magazine.
Harvest Market Natural Foods and Cafe in Hanalei is proud to support KKCR and its ohana, offering organic groceries and produce, a cafe featuring fresh salad bar, hot meals and soups, fresh-made smoothies, and baked goods. Located in the heart of Hanalei, Harvest Market Natural Foods and Cafe, 826-0089.
Kauai Marine and Mower, located in Old Kapa'a Town, is proud to underwrite this KKCR program. Kauai Marine and Mower features Honda Garden and Lawn Equipment and also Echo Power Equipment. 823-0556.
Anahola Stringed Instruments is proud to support KKCR. Mickey Sussman has been building island koa guitars, ukulele, and violins on Kauai since 1972. Time-honored design and special orders. Prompt and complete restoration, repair, and reforestation. AnaholaStringedInstruments.com or 822-1645.
Edible Hawaiian Islands is a subscription-based, advertiser-supported print and digital magazine, the only James Beard Award-winning food and drink magazine in the state of Hawaii. Edible Hawaiian Islands digital magazine may be enjoyed at ediblehi.com.
Yes, we're back. It's great to be here in the studio. Tammy, thanks for coming in today.
You're welcome. Good to be here.
Yay. Tammy was with us about a month ago. We talked about mushrooms. We're going to talk about mushrooms again. It's a whole world. We'll be focusing on some other aspects of mushroom life today on the show, and also great to dip into some permaculture wisdom in designing a new food forest. And we're going to start off, as we do, with our celestial session, looking to the heavenly skies above for inspiration and guidance on our daily, weekly harvesting, planting, and other gardening and farming activities. And we'll start with the Hawaiian moon, brought to us today by the 2015 Western Pacific Regional Fishery Management Council Hawaiian Lunar Calendar, as well as the Astronomical Applications Department of the U.S. Naval Observatory. Today's Hawaiian moon is Kaloa Pau. Kaloa Pau rose over Kauai at 3:28 a.m. this morning, reached her transit, her highest point in the sky, at 10:05 a.m., and she will set this afternoon at 4:39 p.m. 10% of the moon's beautiful face is illuminated today. We have the new moon coming up this Saturday at 8:41 p.m., and we've been looking at trying to understand the beginning of the Hawaiian moon calendar and noting going back to David Malo's observation in Hawaiian Antiquities, really important resource of ancient Hawaiian knowledge from the late 1800s, he said in there, the first appearance of the moon at evening in the west marked the first day of the month. It was called Hilo on account of the moon's slender, twisted form. So we are looking We're looking at the new moon from an astronomical standpoint happening this Saturday at 8:41 p.m. The next day, according to the observatory, the moon is invisible, and that moon is known as Muku, which means cut off or vanished in Hawaiian. So the Hilo moon would be the next moon, and according to the observatory, 2% of the moon is going to be visible on Monday the 14th. So I'm making an effort to get out there at the right time to see if this 2% sliver of moon is visible, which would mark the beginning of the new Hawaiian moon calendar. So if you're interested in joining me in that attempt, this is going to be Monday, again, Monday evening. Sunset happens at 6:42 p.m., the end of civil twilight, which is when it gets hard to see things with any certainty in front of you, is at about 7:05. The moon sets at 7:46, so there's certainly plenty of time after sunset and before moonset at 7:46 to see that sliver of moon. That'll be really interesting to check out, so I encourage you to do that. The Ike, or knowledge, on Kaloa Pau, today's moon, it's the last of three Kaloa moons in Emi, or the diminishing phase of the moon, sacred to the god Kanaloa. Planting recommendations, it's a good time for planting bamboo for braiding hats. Plant plants with long stems, like mai'a, banana, ko, sugarcane, vake, the paper mulberry, and ohe, bamboo, for they will grow long, kaloa. Uala, sweet potato, and uhi, the yam, will run to long vines. And the hala tree, or pandanus tree, will develop long leaves if planted on this day. And that's the Hawaiian moon for you.
All right. For a biodynamic look at things, we are in the descending moon phase, which lasts about 2 weeks. This month, from September 6th to September 20th, it means that the moon is descending through the constellations, just as the sun appears to do during the latter part of the year, from summer solstice to winter solstice. So during the moon's descent, it has been observed in the past that plants take root readily and connect well with their new location. So this would mean really good time to transplant. This is referred to as transplanting time, which distinguishes it from sowing or germination time, which can happen well in both the ascending and descending phases of the moon. So today, the moon is in the constellation of Cancer, which is a water sign, making it good to work with leafy plants. So early Thursday morning, the moon's going to enter Leo, a fire sign, and that would make it good to work with fruiting plants. This influence would last until about Saturday at 6 p.m., at which time there begins an unproductive period. And then early Sunday morning, the moon enters Virgo, which is an earth sign, and that makes it good to work with your rooting plants. This influence continues through Wednesday of next week. However, skipping Sunday from 3 to 10 p.m., which is an unfavorable time for plant work.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. And all of that depending on local weather conditions, and we are looking at maybe some heavy rain through even the beginning of next week. So I'm looking at that Saturday morning. We get out there in the Kauai Food Forest up in Kalihiwai, and a great time for transplanting fruiting plants until 6 p.m. Yet, if it's pouring rain and the water and the ground is super saturated, we won't be doing any planting. So I'm crossing my fingers we get some moderate weather.
Right. You can always transplant into the greenhouse and then take it out when it's really happy to be out in the ground.
Good point. Good point. But the plants in my nursery are
they
like,
want to go in.
Enough with the up-potting. Get me in the soil. So we're going to look at some notable news. This is going to tie into our Secrets of the Soil Builders at the end of the show, as you will see. But we have some concerning news thanks to the College of Tropical Agriculture at the University of Hawaii for their research spreading the news on the rapid ohia death disease. So it just so happened that on August 25th, the Hawaii State Board of Agriculture enacted a quarantine on ohia plants and plant parts originating from the island of Hawaii. Movement of soil from the Big Island will be restricted as well beginning in January of 2016. I can imagine that would be a significant situation for nurseries on the Big Island that provide planting material for throughout the Hawaiian Islands. Pretty serious. And all of this because of the spreading pathogenic vascular wilt fungus. Can you give a try at that botanical name for us?
I would say Ceratocystis.
Yeah.
Ceratocystis fimbriata.
Ooh. And it's causing death of the ohia. This is the Metrosideros polymorpha, one of the keystone trees in the Hawaiian forest. And in, we were talking about it before the show, on the island of Hawaii, because it is the youngest of the main Hawaiian islands, there is a lot less species diversity in the forests. So you can look at areas with, you know, hundreds of square acres, and you pretty much have ohia trees and hapu'u fern as an understory. But it's pretty much that, and it's almost kind of like a monocrop that nature has done. And unfortunately, as we know, monocrops become magnets for problems. And you were suggesting that maybe it was tied in with the effects of the hurricane last year.
I imagine one of the ways that I know that mushrooms move in is when there's a lot of dead, decaying matter. And so with a lot of those trees knocked down in that whole area, the fungi are probably experiencing quite a boon, and sometimes that could maybe lead to an overgrowth of something that maybe was normally kept in check. That's just a thought.
Right. And then the question of how it got there initially, the pathogen, this particular pathogen, has been in Hawaii reportedly for decades as a disease of sweet potato. And so making the jump from, you know, totally across plant families and from a herbaceous plant to a tall woody plant, pretty amazing there. Stands of ohia trees are showing a greater than 50% mortality, sometimes up to 100% in a few years. And then other forest plants appear to be unaffected, at least for now. Mm. And as we look at the plants that we would be more likely be cultivating, perhaps mango, cacao, eucalyptus, as well as the sweet potato, are possible vectors, or rather to say, those are host plants, so we could be having problems with this particular fungus on any one of those crops. And then it's thought that possible vectors or ways in which the infestation is getting transferred, insects, soils, water, infected cuttings, pruning wounds, or tools. And you can get more information from CTAR if you look for CTAR, C-T-A-H-R, and then look for news, 2015 news. You'll get the news report on that. I think this came from the Sustainable Organic Program at CTAR. So really concerning. They're taking, they're actually asking people in the area to send in samples to confirm possible reports. They have great or possible infestations in new areas, but there is a fear that it's going upslope.
Mm. And that's one of the main trees that can just sprout right out of the lava. I've heard the ohia referred to as the alpha and the omega in terms of it coming up first out of the lava and really taking precedence and being able to establish tree life on the lava. And then it lasts a really long time. So it's, in a, you know, providing timber and really big old wood. So it can be one of the last standing. So we were just rooting for this tree in some way, like that it will come into balance and that the survivors will spread the information to other trees, as they often do, on how to best survive this new challenge.
Yeah. We're in such a great time of transformation across the whole planet, as these organisms that have never met each other in evolutionary time finally are doing so. And it seems like a mismatch when you get this kind of problem, which could radically transform an ecosystem. It seems like it's wrong, and certainly the ohia is such a beloved and important cultural plant and ecological plant in the Hawaiian Islands, but it makes me wonder about the bigger design of things and whether or not it was maybe always in the greater design that these two organisms would encounter each other, and the transformation that looks very negative potentially is just leading us to where we're supposed to be headed. I don't know.
Yeah, well, we'll look at that also in our discussion later about saprophytic fungi.
Yeah. So we want to let you know you're listening to In the Garden on the Farm on Kauai Community Radio, and it's Paul, and today we have Tammy filling in for Robin, who's enjoying one more week of vacation. Mm. And she'll be back with us next week. So much love to her. Thanks so much as well to Eileen, who filled in last week, did a super job. And we just love being with you, talking all about gardening and farming activities, and it's great. It's a great opportunity because we have Tammy in today to talk about permaculture design. Tammy is a learned educator and practitioner of permaculture, and is also been working on concepts of agroforestry systems and food forests, which is, as listeners know, is definitely up my alley. I'm very excited to say that the food forest in Kalihiwai is really filling out beautifully. It's really loved all this rain. We're starting to get different fruit trees fruiting that have not fruited before. And I want to put the invitation out for people. We are still meeting on Saturdays from 8:30 until whenever we're done, taking care of the trees. Much thanks to all the people dropping off mulch for us. We have a lot of the raw materials needed to really care for the forest. It's a very exciting time to be working in there, and so great invitation out to everyone to come and join us on a Saturday morning up in Kalihiwai at Waikoa Plantation. Yet, right now we're going to talk about, rather than talking about an existing food forest, we're going to take a stab at designing a new forest and look at the different considerations, maybe do things a little bit differently than we did it the last time because of the things we've learned. So,
yeah, I mean, I was just interested in if you were, interested in making a food forest, what kind of things would you be looking for if you were going to buy a piece of land or acquire access to a piece of land, because we don't always have to own it to create a food forest like we did here in Kalihiwai Food Forest. And so what are the things we're looking for in a site assessment? What are we wanting to avoid and what would be optimal? Do you want a south-facing slope? Do you want it to be pretty flat? Do you even attempt to do a food forest on a slope? Maybe you can't garden in some area and you'd be better off with a food forest. So a lot of different things could go into your site assessment and selecting a site. I think there's a lot of variables to look at, but our food forest has a slight slope and a nice water drainage area. So it's nice to have, I think, a moderate slope just so you can predict where the water's going to go. You're not just sitting in a big flooded area.
Right.
That's pretty important.
But emphasis on the moderate.
Very moderate.
Because there is a lot of topography on this island, and it's great to utilize all spaces, but can be extremely challenging working on a slope. Going up and down is really, really a hard time. And I went to see somebody's new food forest kind of recently, and right away said, gee, really, do you want to do it up on a slope like this? Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. So then we were touring the land, and then eventually it was time to go see it. And it was like, well, we can see it from here. I was like, well, if we can't even walk up to the trees when it's time to haul the mulch and haul the fertilizer or whatever it might be, it's really worthwhile considering that. Of course, if there's a nice road at the top of the slope and you can just carry things down, that's a super way to do it as well. But drainage, very important. And like with any gardening farming project, as we heard on last week's show with Dr. Jonathan Dienick's new Hawaii Soil Atlas, we can become informed about the inherent qualities of a soil in a new site before we ever get too deep into the project, really. So that's a new resource from the College of Tropical Agriculture, and a simple internet search for Hawaii Soil Atlas will lead you to this GIS-enabled website that'll let you look at the soil types and all that kind of thing.
And that will tell you basically how much preparation you're going to need before you want to plant anything. I mean, on some of the soil types, there's more nutrients and some have way less. And so you'd want to look at how easy is it going to be to work the soil, the texture of the soil, does it drain well, is it going to hold nutrients, is it going to be just super heavy clay and hard to, move things around in. So mm-hmm. I think those are some of the first things is water and nutrients and access to sunlight and then wind. These are some of the basic things that you can perceive by going to a site.
And wind is a good thing. We want everything in moderation. Mm. A site with no wind is a real problem, especially for us up here in the rainy part of the island, because you don't get the drying effect of the wind. Yeah. And so really, really happy situation for pathogenic fungi or bacteria problems to arise. Certainly, we want all things in moderation. Also, bug problems can be more present in a really stagnant area, too, because it becomes a refuge where they don't get blown away.
It's nice to have the mosquitoes kind of blowing by instead of sitting around on here.
That as well, for sure. And then we're looking at the existing cover of the land, too. And that makes me think about how we might design a food forest in coming times. We have, next to the Kauai food forest, we have these giant albizia trees. Mm-hmm. And they are beyond our ability to manage with a simple chainsaw or small work crew. They're kind of beyond that. But when I look at the forest floor underneath those albizia trees, I think, you know, with a little bit of change of management, this site actually was probably better. That would be more fertile ground for planting a food forest than just a mowed field, because there's such a dropping, there's such a huge leaf litter drop that happens over a period of time, such a huge amount of root system underground, the nitrogen fixation that's happened. And so all these kind of thoughts make me think about some initial things that we might do to prepare the site. And I think we're familiar in the garden setting with doing cover crops, where we're increasing the organic matter by growing things like sun hemp or Sudan grass or buckwheat that are going to get turned into the soil. When we're looking at a food forest, we could be doing that on a larger scale and actually planning out enough time so that maybe even a couple of years or bit longer before we actually plant our ultimate fruiting species, we're just growing a diverse collection of large statured plants, like fast-growing nitrogen-fixing trees, like the chaya, mm-hmm. which is one of the most amazing biomass plants out there. Just growing a lot of organic matter right in place, chopping it down, letting it start to decompose, and building the soil. I think that here on Kauai especially, the soil is so depleted in so many places, and the forest really depends on having that rich humus layer. It would be great to kind of build it up before we planted.
Yeah, and if you stay on top of, I think, managing these trees, it's just like if you let a cover crop go too long, it's going to become woody and harder to take down. And earlier, the earlier you chop it down and grind it up into smaller bits, then the faster it can turn into soil. Right. And I think a lot of these trees, you know, we look at as problem weed trees were dropped from a helicopter on purpose to kind of reforest the ground. But now we have to keep up with them. So instead of letting them get to such a huge stature, we need to stay on it. So any of you who have albizia or African tulip or cecropias or any of these trees that sprout and just really quickly grow, mm-hmm. just think that is your soil. That is your future soil. So get on it soon and grind it up and chop it down and let it decompose and let the mushrooms do their thing so you'll have better soil.
Yeah, and less hauling of stuff around. Again, we're really grateful at the food forest now to have a lot of mulch. We were very mulch deficient for a long time, and now it's back. So yeah. We're spreading it as much as we can, but it is a lot of labor moving all that material around. And as we look at the whole island, is there enough chipped woody matter for all the people who would like to make a food forest or to feed all the people? Maybe not. So we need to be more innovative about growing it right in place.
Yes, and I have another solution for that woody matter, which I've been using on my site, which is providing a pit. If you can get a pit dug, and then you stack the woody debris in the pit, and so you can, you know, chop it up minimally. You don't have to grind it all the way up into chips, but you basically stack firewood-sized logs into this pit and layer it with branches and logs and branches and logs, and then you put the topsoil back on top, so you end up with a mound. So this is a technique called hugel culture, mm-hmm. and I've used that quite extensively with most of my weedy trees because we didn't have a mulcher. We didn't have a chip or shredder, and it's worked great, and it's decomposing. The pit is, probably 5 feet deep that we actually were able to dig a really deep pit, and now it's starting to get more level, but we planted cover, root crops on top of it. We've gotten lots of initial harvests of tubers and things, and once the woody debris starts to decompose from the mushroom activity, then you can plant fruit trees right into that. and it's got a lot more nutrients than the soil had before. Mm-hmm. It's absorbing a lot of moisture and rotting, and then eventually it becomes a great nutrient base for whatever tree you put on top.
Awesome. So that seems to contradict what I've heard in other circles, and I'm glad you brought it up because this has been a question in my head, is that in general, and maybe it's just more for the garden setting, you don't want to, or we're encouraged not to bury unbroken down carbon rich yeah. material into the soil, but that's exactly what this process is doing.
Right. It's a matter of time. I think it's a function of time. If you take a bunch of wood chips and dig it into the first 2 or 3, you know, inches of your topsoil, you're going to really rob the nutrients, the nitrogen in particular, that it's going to rob out of the soil. But if you bury waste deeper and you let it sit for longer, that after that initial period of using up a lot of nitrogen in order to, you know, decompose that wood, then you start to get a buildup of nutrients. So I think it's a matter of function of time. Mm-hmm. Longer, and in this environment, deep down like that, I think it's amazing how fast these pieces of wood rot, because they're fast growing. They're usually pretty soft. So they're rotting pretty fast, I've noticed. But, you know, I did wait about 3 years before I planted the fruit tree on top of the berm.
Okay.
So it's a function of time.
What about planting nitrogen-fixing trees right away?
Yeah, and I did that. I put pigeon peas.
They do fine.
Yeah, and they do great, and that helps to add. And so, again, I was just growing root crops and tubers on the surface of the soil. I wasn't growing anything in the first few years that needed to tap down into that.
Right. Cool. That's a great system. So let's use some more hookah culture. I know that's popular with Eileen, who was in with us last week, and Felicia uses it in Akamai Backyard to great effect. So I want to do some more hookah culture for sure. Mm. So establishing our food forest, we want to think about scale too, and I know this is a big pitfall that many of us can get into quite easily, is the ambition to plant a huge area. And thinking about maintenance, we went through the growing pains of initially holding the vision that we would be able to maintain the food forest by handwork only, and no power tools would be used inside the forest itself. And we did pretty well while the cardboard mulch was entirely covered the ground. But once the pigs got in, the weeds got back in, we were way out of control, and the way in which we'd chosen to manage the forest made it impossible to bring in a mower, for mm-hmm. instance. So we had to do a lot of recovery, and now, fortunately, we are back on track, and we have these maintenance corridors that are mowed, and so much thanks to Malama Kauai and Luboff, our partners there, for doing the mowing even in the past few days. The place is looking really good, and it just makes it a whole lot easier to access the space. So that was our solution for a much bigger area. But Craig Elovich, who helped to bring us the agroforestry workshop that happened earlier in the year, is encouraging people now to consider doing these island plantings. And I think it was 30 feet in diameter islands. And just doing one at a time, because yeah. the maintenance, now that sounds like a lot of edge to me, but at the same time, it's a manageable size and people are having success. And maybe if you're developing these 30 foot islands, you can only do as many as you can do.
Yeah. And that's one way to keep it scaled to where you can handle it. And then eventually they become contiguous if you can expand. I have one called, ironically, the Island Garden, that I started with just 3 soursop trees. And then I just put a border around those of lemongrass and a bamboo fence to keep the pigs out. Learning a lot from the first, you know, attempts at the food forest, I kept seeing, I was, you know, watching what was happening and then trying to avoid some of the same mistakes. And so keeping out the pigs was pretty important, I saw. And also not over trimming. When we did have a nice shady coverage, it suppressed a lot of the grass below. And then if we chop and drop too vigorously, it lets in way more light really quickly. So that, you know, that was also something I was noting and watching. But with my little island garden, I just kept it really small and tight, and it always felt like, oh, this is too small. But, you know, 3 years later, you won't believe how much food it's growing in there, because I have fig tree, and I have, you know, in between these three soursops, which I put at traditional orchard spacing about 20, 25 feet apart in a triangle. I have so many things packed in there, from vines growing, you know, the sweet potato growing on the ground. I have turmeric underneath the bushes. I have pigeon peas around each fruit tree, a fig tree, a cotton bush, poha berries, comfrey, taro, all these things just in this one little island. It's amazing how much food just comes out of that one place. Way easier to maintain because there's just lawn around it. I can mow in circles around it. But also, there's no grass inside there. It's all, you know, sweet potato vines suppressed a lot of those things, and the other plants are planted so thickly. I did use quite a bit of wood chip mulch in the beginning, and I didn't use cardboard, but I definitely had a really nice thick layer of mulch until the plants could cover it.
Right. Cool. That seems like a really, I want to try one, even though we've got this full food forest, just to get that concept of, it seems like you have achieved that, not only the diversity, but also the various components, all of the statures that we want to have, and doing it in a small, manageable way allows, even if we can't do it on the larger scale at the big food forest, to have something where it's like that demonstration. So it's that learning opportunity for us to say, okay, this is the full expression on a small scale.
And those, some of those layers are going to be something that's a tuber, like a root underneath the ground. You want to include one plant that's, you know, from that zone. A herbaceous layer of something that's, you know, like a little herb or plant that just only grows a couple feet high or something. Some small shrubs. You want to have a lot of diversity of shrubs, and then dwarf fruit trees is another layer higher, and then some kind of overstory, something that's going to be your climax. And then you also want to include vines or some sort of vine to be able to use some of the bigger trees as like a ladder. So you're really just maximizing every type of, you know, surface and space within that zone.
Yeah. Very cool. And do you think that over time that particular island garden will be able to, as the soursop trees fill out and create more shade, do you think that you'll be able to maintain all those various statures of plants and elements in the system, or is it going to get simpler?
That's when I think you grow and you expand outward. You keep following that. You know, you let the shade determine maybe how big of a space you can cultivate in. And I think that's a good time to expand because, you know, certain things are going to get overshaded when the trees get bigger. And I do plan to prune and keep things tight. And that makes the fruit more accessible for harvesting. But as things get bigger, things can spread out. And I know there's this Hawaiian idea of a kapuka. Kipuka. Mm-hmm. So you have, you know, all of the species that you want to see happen in the whole forest, but tightly packed in this one zone. And then you can slowly expand those out. So as the shade circle grows bigger, then you plant more on the perimeter. And a lot of them are perennials, but after 3 or 4 years, they're going to want to be restarted.
Right.
So make cuttings from everything you have. And then when it's time to expand out, you just pop those new cuttings in and around the new outside edge.
Mm-hmm. Super cool. So, thinking about plant material and different species that have worked well or not so well. Chaya, I had mentioned previously, and a magnificent plant in that it no insect or disease problems. It doesn't seem you need to fertilize it. It's just, it is at least reported to be highly nutritious. I really want to crack the nut on eating more chaya.
Okay.
But I'm wondering if that's a plant that you have used more or less, or what you feel about it, because I kind of wonder, it's another plant that when you throw it on the ground, it will readily re-root. And so I'm kind of considering it as, is this an ideal biomass plant, or does it have qualities that make it less favorable for that?
I kept chaya out of mine because I've heard also that the leaves can be irritating, the sap, or, you know. Mm-hmm. So I have it someplace where there's more space around. So I think for a larger area, that would be great because then you can just chop and spread it really easily to try and cover bigger spaces. Mm-hmm. For that little tight space, I stuck with pigeon peas, and there's, you know, there's a couple of other, like comfrey I use like that. I just chop and drop and let it resprout. So for nutrient and biomass, I just like having in that little tight of a space. I didn't put any in there, right. But I do have it outside on a different part of our land where we're trying to expand faster, you know?
Mm-hmm. And as well, thinking about some plants that we had in quantity in the food forest, but because the pigs came, the cassava and the malanga, that large leaf elephant ear relative of taro, that are such great plants that take little care and make huge amounts of food. Are you taking the risk of growing them in your system without a fence?
Or? No, I have been eradicating or sort of keeping the pigs out. And so, you know, we've had some local help from some of the locals to reduce our pig population as well as fencing. We can't fence our whole site, so there are risks and corridors. But I just really pay attention for signs of pig and, you know, when it's time, call in some local assistance. So that's been really helpful. And I think that is part of the management of a larger forest. You need to be out in it regularly, and you need to see the signs of what's happening and where the wildlife corridors are coming and going. And I think that's another thing about site selection. Our site, you can't really fence the whole property, so I fence smaller areas and then put the sensitive things inside of there to keep the pigs out, and the things I don't think the pigs are most likely to bother, I'd put outside of there.
Right. Cool. And as far as permaculture observations go, I'm curious to know what other things you've been learning about these systems as they've evolved through time. I know I see so little insect damage in a food forest as compared to a garden setting.
Yeah, and I'm amazed how fast, if there is something that gets, you know, eaten up, you just have to stay flexible in what you're growing. So, you know, something that just kept getting, you know, diseased or didn't have enough airflow or something, I just let something else that was more successful be the more prominent thing. Mm-hmm. So there's one thing learning, you know, what's going to work and not work by trying a lot of diversity and then just going with what works well. And then maybe that one plant just isn't going to be happy in that environment, so letting it move along to wherever it's more happy. And so letting things balance out that way, just watching and moving things slightly. There was, you know, for a while that we had this poha berry, just wouldn't do well. But eventually, once everything else grew up around it, maybe it was just baking too hard in the sun or something was happening where it wasn't getting enough of what it needed. And then I was about to give up on it. And then all of a sudden things got really crowded around it, and then it just blossomed and somehow surprised me, right? It came back. It made a comeback, and now it's producing lots of berries. Cool. So just watching and learning.
Right.
Yeah.
There are definitely times in my evolution with the food forest where I felt that feeling of discouragement. It's not working out like I thought it would. The weeds are bigger than the productive plants, and there's more of them. And I get so stuck in the moment, mm-hmm. that moment in time. And now the way things have evolved, I laugh that I was so pessimistic. Maybe I'll laugh that I'm so optimistic now. But that expanse of time, and then even with the huge changes that we've seen in 2.5 years, to realize that this is the beginning of like 2.5-3 years, and this forest is going to be here for so long. We're such at the beginning stages. And so that's really exciting. And just that feeling of being in a forest and knowing that that feeling is going to deepen as the abundance of the forest, the organic matter gets thicker, the soil gets deeper. Is a pretty cool thing to consider.
Agreed. I just encourage everyone just to start small and try it out. And like I said, I just started with 3 fruit trees and made a circle around them. And, you know, looking at what's going to happen later. And you could even, you know, have something that's going to be successional after you think, wow, and my fruit trees, you know, maybe in 50 to 100 years, there could be a timber tree kind of tucked under one side that's going to grow really tall and thin and, you know, take over. So just thinking about your food forest in a longer term manner, and just go for it. Just start now, you know, just try it out.
And if you want lots of great resources, we can point you toward agroforestry.net. This is Craig Elovich's encyclopedic website of so many informational resources, free publications. You can purchase books there as well, but it's really so much information available, very specific to Hawaii and then also to the other Pacific Islands. And a recent publication that we included as part of the agroforestry workshop, Agroforestry Landscapes for Pacific Islands, Creating Abundant and Resilient Food Systems, is a new hardcover book by Craig Elovich, sitting in front of me right here. And if you took the agroforestry workshop and you didn't get your book yet because you did not return an email to us, I'm going to have these books at the Food Forest a week from this Saturday. This is going to be the third Saturday when we have a nice work party. We'll also have some books for sale as well. Beautiful manual on creating your own food forest. But if you took the workshop, you've got a book coming to you. But we need you to show up at the food forest, and you can stay and work with us or just get your book. But great to share community with you in that way. And if you, any more questions, you can call me later at 652-4118 to get involved in that. So this is In the Garden on the Farm on Kauai Community Radio. We're here until 1 o'clock, at which time Tracy will be bringing you Kauai Vibrations until 3. And lots more good programming after that. And right now, Tammy and I are going to look down. We've been standing in the food forest and admiring all this beautiful growth and all this quick development that happens in a subtropical setting. But now we're going to look down to our feet and see that there are these amazing organisms at work that we depend on so much for the development of the soil. And these are the saprophytic mushrooms.
Yeah, there's a lot of different ways of looking at fungi. And one of them is that, you know, some of these mushrooms are considered parasitic as compared to saprophytic. So something that lives on its host until the host, you know, perishes.
Like the Ohia death fungus we just
A parasite with something that kills its host. That's how it's been classically defined. And saprophytic is something that has found that it feeds on dead and decaying things, something that's already injured or weak or already dying or lives in harmony for a while with something. So it's something that's going to be cleaning up all the debris.
So saprophytic, sapro meaning the root of these words. Sapro is like refuse, and phytic is to grow. So it's organisms that grow on decaying plant matter. And mushrooms are certainly a very important part of that, but I also noted, and I didn't really look deeper into it, but they're actually plants. There are flowering plants that don't photosynthesize and actually derive their nutrients also from decaying plant matter.
Yeah.
So those would be pretty cool to throw in our food forest system at some point or another.
Yeah. I looked at one example of something that we had always called a parasitic mushroom called the honey mushroom. It's an edible mushroom. It grows often in the Southwest. And it's growing on this really large aspen tree colony. And so the aspen trees are miles and miles across.
And all one organism, right, as well?
So yeah, the aspen, considered.
Aspens are kind of like banana stalks coming from a central, an underground sort of basis, yeah?
Yeah, so there's this huge colony of aspen trees, and then there's this considered parasitic mushroom, the honey mushroom, that's growing on these aspen trees. And so they noticed the aspen tree colony would die down, and these honey mushrooms were considered a parasitic blight. And so, but the longer they studied it, the more they realized that the actual colony of honey mushrooms was even bigger than the aspen colony, and it was the same genetic species from one side to the other, miles across. And it had been there three times longer than the forest. And so there'd been three, you know, aspen colonies that had arisen and died and arisen and died. And that same mushroom was still there. So you think, well, who's the parasite? You know, who was there first and who's been there longer? And maybe either the mushroom is gardening and it's growing its own food and then, you know, planting another crop, or it's been there longer and the trees are only able to exist there because of the colony of honey mushrooms. potentially, because they share nutrients and they make all the things that are harder for the trees to find more abundantly available, because their little mycelial threads are finer and can go further out into the soil into smaller and smaller pockets. So they bring back all these incredible nutrients and exchange them with the trees for their photosynthetic sugars. So that's one of the roles that we've seen that mushrooms play for all these plants. And yeah, who's the parasite? Who knows?
Wow. Well, without pointing fingers, we can say that the saprophytic mushrooms are doing an irreplaceable service to cycle nutrients in the system, break down organic matter, creating stable humus, which raises our CEC and makes plant nutrients available, and it's a basis of life on Earth, basically, probably almost every ecosystem. And we have a lot of them here on the rainy North Shore of Kauai, and Tammy, as much as anybody here living on the North Shore, has been paying attention to the diversity of mushrooms beneath our feet. Some of these are edible, medicinal, or question marks. And we had a giant mushroom growing in the food forest of Kalihiwai over a few seasons, and people who saw it just always remarked, like, you gotta come down and see this thing. And Tammy, you told me you were doing some research on identifying this mushroom.
Yeah, this mushroom also showed up in my hugelkultur mounds, and so it was just fruiting out of the sides of these berms in huge clusters. Sometimes one of the mushrooms would end up being, you know, 10, 12 inch caps across and really fat stems and pure white with a white spore print in clusters on wood. So these are some of the identifying characteristics. They didn't seem to stain or turn any other color as they were decaying. I mean, they start to turn a little brown when they rot, but they're not obviously turning into, you know, a brown cap or any other color feature. And so I put a picture out there on some of my mushroom sites to see who could identify it. It's not something I'm that familiar with. It wasn't in the 100 or so that I know just from looking. And then I can look through my books. I didn't see it anywhere there. So I put it out further, and it seems that it's most likely. I'm still on the hunt, so until I get a pure, you know, botanical description and I am able to compare it side by side, there's a mushroom cultivated in India called the milky mushroom, and it's Colossibe indica. And so it seems like it's most likely that it's an edible mushroom. If we confirm it, it would be really exciting, because it's something that's just naturally growing. It's naturalized. It doesn't mean that it's from here, but it happens to be happy. It's a saprophytic mushroom, so it's not going to attack and kill off our fruit orchard. It could be a really great protein source and cultivatable. You know, I think there are people selling them at farmers markets. So anyways, it's an exciting lead, and we'll have to look further. I as somebody who knows a lot about mushrooms, one thing I definitely know is I never eat a mushroom that has not been positively identified by at least one or two or three experts, because it's just really risky. So I just want to encourage people to really just take pause. There's no way to identify a mushroom and say, oh, that looks poisonous, or it doesn't look poisonous, or it tastes good or it doesn't taste good is not a good indicator. Some of the most deadly mushrooms that grow here on the island are the Amanitas, which are also can be pure white. And they might taste delicious in a meal, and then 24 hours later, your liver shuts down, and pretty quickly it shuts down your system. So just a little, you know, remembering that mushrooms can be incredibly powerful, both in a really healthy ways, and also can take you out real quick.
Truly. Thank you for that reminder. I'm curious to know, so this particular mushroom, if this is the positive identification, and it is considered very beneficial from an edible standpoint in other parts of the world, are there strains of the same species? Like we would think about varieties from the plant world, where maybe one of them is more digestible than another of the same species.
Yeah, I looked up. There's probably like 10 or 12 of Colossibe, and then has a different species name. Right. So there's a lot of different variations on it. This is hopefully, if it's the milky mushroom, then we can keep. I can actually clone it and share it, as the mycelium is a healthy colony. You can take a very small fleshy part of the mushroom and then grow it out on cardboard. It seems to like to grow on woody waste. On the books it says it can grow on, you know, straw or agricultural waste. We see it growing on little downed pieces of wood or logs underground. So it'd be easy to share it. And So what's important about these things is that they're taking the woody matter that has a lot of lignans and chitin and hard cell walls, and there's not really anything other than a mushroom that can digest that stuff. So imagine when you're in the desert and you see an old juniper tree that's died, it's there for years and years and years because there's not much moisture to feed the fungi to break it down, and there's not really anything that can just go bite into that and chew it and eat it. So even termites, I think, have help. You know, in their stomach, they have other things that grow in there that help them digest. Right. So basically, you're looking at the fungi as an important keystone species for regenerating our nutrients in the system. They're really crucial. So we want to encourage the saprophytic ones sort of as a way to also buffer against the parasitic and the, the pathogenic ones.
Right.
So the more healthy mushroom colonies you have, the more diversity you have in your forest, I think the more protected your forest is from some of these parasitic blights and things like that. So that's another reason, besides they're edible or they're medicinal or they're cool to look at, another reason to really like look at what can we inoculate our systems with that are going to be beneficial.
Right. And knowing what you're inoculating with, because I thought before, oh, if I see any rotting log that has mycelium or mushrooms popping, fruiting bodies popping out of it, more is better. Drag all that stuff into the system, into the food forest. But if it's one of these part parasitic or pathogenic ones, so do you know of ones that we should be actively avoiding? And the converse of that is, are there particular saprophytic mushrooms that we are so good that we want to like go out and find them and bring them into the system?
My advice would be the ones that are parasitic or pathogenic tend not to have a fruiting body, so you wouldn't know it by its fruiting body. They tend to have either very small or you can't really see the fruit. Mm-hmm. So I would say just encouraging the good ones. We know that's a good idea. Mm-hmm. And also, if a tree does die of some kind of wilt or rot, don't use that wood for mulch. Okay. You know, take that somewhere and try to isolate it from the system. Those are the only ways I think that we can really, because we don't know, they're so small and you can't really tell from the mycelium what kind is what. So just encouraging, it's like using probiotics, using pro-saprophytic mushrooms to inoculate our systems is, I think, the best approach.
Cool. So going into a healthy stand of trees, if there are fallen limbs in a perfectly healthy-looking stand of trees that have evidence of mushrooms growing on them, that's probably a safe bet.
Yeah, it's definitely a way to encourage the kind of like the IMOs, the indigenous microorganisms. Like we're looking for what is a healthy, diverse system, and then trying to spread those organisms that are working well together in a colony, and then spread that to new areas when you plant.
Cool. Do you want to give a quick sort of mention of that great book?
Yeah, the one book that I came to Hawaii and was looking at identifying mushrooms that I've been finding really useful is Mushrooms of Hawaii, an Identification Guide. And it's Don Hames, Ph.D., and Dennis Desjardins, Ph.D. And it's, I don't exactly know if that's how you say his name, but it's Desjardin. And Hames is Hemmes. So Hames and Desjardins. Mm-hmm. And this is the one book I found of just Hawaiian mushrooms. It's really useful.
It's a super beautiful book. Highly recommended. So we've got just a few minutes left, and Cousin Rich is actually in here for Quiet Vibrations. It looks like he's pulling out some great music right now from the archives. And we'll do a few quick announcements and bid you a fond farewell until next week. Please.
All right, some announcements. The Hawaii Farmers Union United monthly potluck meeting is Wednesday, September 9th.
That's today.
6 to 8:30 p.m. at the Anahola Clubhouse. The main topic for today would be building a successful market for your farm, challenges and innovative approaches. Also, we have the 25th Annual Hawaii International Tropical Fruit Conference, Friday through Sunday, September 25th through 27th. It is in the Courtyard King Kamehameha's Kona Beach Hotel in Kailua Kona, Hawaii Island, featuring keynote rare fruit explorer Joseph Simcox, and fruit tour is led by fruit expert Tom Baldwin. For more information, including the conference agenda, you can go to a website, which is http://hawaiitropicalfruitgrowers.org. Also, we have USDA program helps offsetting transportation costs for farmers and ranchers in Hawaii, so that would be super helpful. Applicants must submit their application to an administrative county FSA office by September 11th. Is that already passed?
That's Friday.
Okay, so
just
Friday.
Just a couple more days to sign up for this great program.
So for more information about that, you can call 245-9014. And also, we have an announcement from Idaho Community Park and the Porter Pavilion are having a propagation party at the nonprofit site in Kilauea on Tuesday, 15th of September, from 9 to 12 a.m. Planting and learning methods presented by Bino Castello Plants propagated at the event will be among the first to begin to fill a community greenhouse inventory to give away to Kauaians on an ongoing basis at the site. So that's very exciting. Get a little education on propagation from Bino. Sounds great. Please meet at the greenhouse and bring gloves, water, and pruners if possible. And you can call 828-2118 for further information. This is a free event, and I highly encourage you to go learn some propagation.
Yeah, fantastic. We want to let you know, if you want to hear previous broadcasts of In the Garden on the Farm, you can go to kkcr.org, click the audio archive link at the top of the page, and you'll find all our shows for the past couple of years. We want to thank the rest of the In the Garden on the Farm team, our phone tech Mac, who's with us each and every week. Thank you, Mac. We want to thank our station manager, Dean, our webmaster, Laura Christine. We want to thank all of you for listening. This has been In the Garden on the Farm on Kauai Community Radio. And please, we want to encourage you to consider tuning in again next week for more stimulating conversation on our relationship with the life of the land that gives us life. Aloha, everyone.
And a great show out of the garden on a Wednesday, 12 to 1. Great seeing you, Paul. Well, this is Cousin Rich sitting in for my good friend Tracy, Kauai Vibrations, KKCR, KKCR Hanalei, KAQA, Kilauea, K224CQ Anahola, K284AL Haleiwa. Good afternoon.
Let's write a story.